Welcome to AUSA's Army Matters podcast. I'm Carter Hamm, the president of AUSA, and I'll be your host. Our guest today is Army Lieutenant General Charles Hooper, director of the Defense Security Cooperation Agency. General Hooper grew up just outside of Philadelphia and is a lifelong and very passionate Philadelphia Eagles fan. He graduated from West Point in 1979 and served as an infantry officer at Fort Knox in Hawaii and with the 82nd Airborne Division. He spent some time in recruiting command before transitioning to become a foreign area officer specializing in China. He earned a master's degree at Harvard University. He has held numerous positions with the Army and in the Office of the Secretary of Defense focused on U.S. policy regarding China. And he has twice been assigned to China, ultimately serving there as America's defense attaché in Beijing. I first served with General Hooper when he joined United States Africa Command. He went on from there to be the Chief of Office of Defense Cooperation in Cairo, Egypt. Truly an incredible journey and an extraordinary life of service to the nation. General Hooper, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, sir, and thank you so much for that kind introduction.
Well, we've known each other for a large number of years, and you know how highly I think of you and your service, and it truly has been an extraordinary journey that has ended with you here at the Defense Security Cooperation Agency. If you would, tell our listeners a bit about what is DSCA? What are your missions, and how are you organized?
Well, thank you very much, and I often joke that DSCA is the agency that does more and is known by fewer people than any other agency in the Department of Defense. So to make it succinct, I'm going to read to you from Title 10, Section 382 of the National Defense Authorization Act, and it describes DSCA as follows. The director of the Defense Security Cooperation Agency shall be responsible for the execution and administration of all security cooperation programs and activities of the Department of Defense involving the provision of defense articles, military training, and other defense-related services by grant, loan, cash, sale, or lease. So what that means is we have responsibility for the management of the foreign military and the execution of the foreign military sales process. We're responsible for the excess defense articles process. We're responsible for the five Department of Defense regional centers. So, for example, the George C. Marshall Center in Garmisch, Germany, that many of the listeners are familiar with, and also the Daniel K. Inouye Center for Asia-Pacific Security Studies out in Honolulu. So we are responsible for the breadth and depth of our security cooperation execution for the department and the management of security cooperation. We're also responsible for the Defense Security Cooperation University, which is the principal education institution for the security cooperation profession, and we are the proponent in DOD for the civilian security cooperation career field, something we're very proud about. So we have a pretty broad and deep portfolio.
That's a big mission. Just to put things in perspective, how much money do you oversee each year?
Well, that, sir, is a great question I want to answer for your audience. So many people don't realize by law, the Arms Export Control Act, arms sales and security assistance must be conducted at no expense to the U.S. taxpayer. So we are one of the few self-funded DOD agencies. The majority of our budget, although we have a small Title 10 budget, the majority of our operating capital is actually derived from a 3.2% surcharge on everything the United States sells. So we are a revenue-generating entity, and last year we were responsible for managing over $55 billion in sales. So my job is part running a DOD agency, but the other half of my hat is running a $55 billion a year revenue generating entity.
Well, for myself and all U.S. taxpayers, we're thankful for that. Thanks for that information. I suspect you're right. Most people don't know about that. General Hooper, you're about to wrap up your service as the director of DSCA. What would you say has surprised you the most over the past 3 years that you've led the organization? And more generally, how have you seen the security assistance environment change over the past few years?
Wow. Well, the first question is an easy one, sir. What surprised me most was the enormous complexity of our security cooperation and foreign military sales process. I remember when you and I were downrange at AFRICOM and we were trying to get those great capabilities to our African partners, and sometimes things seemed to be delayed. And I remember you coming to me saying, what's taking so long? And I'd go back to DSCA and I'd say, this is pretty simple. What's taking so long? We just need to get X to Y. But what I discovered when I assumed responsibility for DSCA is foreign military sales and DSCA and security cooperation is enormously complex. I like to say there is nothing military at all about foreign military sales or security cooperation. It is a political, diplomatic, informational, and economic process that is overseen by the State Department and executed by the Department of Defense. And I use it as an example in our own Army. And oh, by the way, there is no one who is in charge of it. None of the stakeholders and none of the agencies responsible, I'm not in charge of any of them. And I cite as an example our Army. So I deal with two principal agencies in our Army. That is the Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Army for Defense, Exports, and Cooperation, DASADEC, and the U.S. Army Security Assistance Command, USASEC. Well, DASADEC, or the U.S. Army Security Assistance Command, does not work for the Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Army for Defense, Exports, and Cooperation. They both have a very important role in security cooperation, but they're not aligned under each other. As everyone knows, USASEC works for the Army Materiel Command Commander. And then, of course, DASADEC answers to the Secretary of the Army. So it's the complexity that surprised me most. Many stakeholders, no real senior authority. And it compelled me to become more of a chairman of the board, more of a committee leader or a committee chairman to bring people together to help give them guidance to work together to find the right balance to move forward. And as to the second question, how things have changed, they've changed enormously over the tenure of my 3 years. I like to say I was very lucky. I came to this job at a time where we had what I'd like to call a perfect storm of authorities. And what I mean by that is there were three principal authorities that helped to create the conditions for me to be successful in this job. The first one was the National Defense Authorization Act of 2017. And the reason that that was helpful is because the Congress directed the reorganization of security cooperation and the streamlining of it to make it more efficient and effective, and call for two things that we've accomplished that I'm very proud of: the establishment of a civilian career field for security cooperation as number one, and number two, the establishment of a university to provide the educational and training foundation for that civilian career field. The second authority was the administration's conventional arms transfer reform of those authorities, and the objective of that was once again to streamline and make more efficient and effective our efforts to provide our partners with military capabilities and to kind of help compress those timelines between the identification of a capability necessary for our partners and its delivery. And the third thing that really helped was the National Defense Strategy, which has three lines of effort. The second line of effort is the one that provides clear guidance to me as to what my mission is, and that is to strengthen alliances and attract new partners. So we've had this convergence of authorities. That's the first change that I've seen. The second one was I've seen security cooperation become a policy tool of first resort. Often in the past, it was kind of an afterthought. We'd come up with a policy, a security policy. We'd implement that policy towards a country or an alliance. And then as an afterthought, we'd consider military capabilities. But with the second line of effort in the National Defense Strategy, security cooperation has become a tool of first resort. And the last thing I've seen change is our approach to security cooperation and the definition of that. The great power competition forced me as DSCA director to sit down and decide, okay, what are our strengths? What are our challenges? And what are the strengths of our strategic competitors? And what are their weaknesses? And I came to the conclusion that there is a uniquely American approach to security cooperation, and that distinguishes us from our strategic competitors, and that instead of trying to mimic their procedures, we should leverage our strengths. And those strengths are embodied in the four values that we have: transparency of all that we do with our partners, responsiveness to their needs, the integrity and the uncorruptibility of the U.S. approach, and our commitment to a long-term relationship past the point of sale and past the transactional relationship. So those are the biggest changes I've seen over the course of my tenure, sir.
Well, thanks, Joe Hooper. I think it informs all of us of the complexity that you have to deal with, not only within the U.S. government, but in the international marketplace as well. As you talked about that and talked about competitors in the international market, how are you doing? How would you benchmark DSCA more generally? How would you say the U.S. is doing in that competitive marketplace?
First of all, I think we're doing well. And how well are we doing? Well, over the last three-year period, we have seen a 16% increase in our foreign military sales. So I think we're holding our own. And I wanted to begin with that because there are many people that are under the false perception that even though it is more competitive, and it is, and I'll talk about that in a minute, that somehow we're losing. And we're not losing at all. In fact, we're growing over time. Now, I will say this. Our strategic competitors have the benefit of autocratic, streamlined arms sales processes and government-subsidized defense industries. So I have to determine how we maintain our competitive edge and continue to expand our market share when they have systems that allow them to react quickly and are reflective, frankly, of their governmental systems, whereas we have a democracy. And as we all know, democracy was designed for effectiveness and not efficiency. So there are a couple of points that I want to make that kind of illustrate how I believe we can continue to be competitive. The first and foremost is we need to continue to support our U.S. defense industrial base and U.S. industry in continuing to research, develop, and produce the world's most advanced and high-demand systems. The demand for our high-quality, high-technology systems will continue to make us competitive in the market, and nothing can substitute for that. Now, when we do that, of course, we have to improve our ability to engineer exportability into the beginning of our research and development process and not at the end. Right now, what we do is we design a system for our own forces, and then we go back and re-engineer it for export. We don't have the time to do that anymore. We have to incorporate and integrate exportability into the beginning of our RD&A process. So that's the first thing we need to do. The second thing we need to do, and it's something I've worked on very hard during my tenure, is we need to compress the decision timelines for technology, security, and export cost-benefit analysis without sacrificing due diligence. And what I mean by that is our system is set up to vet whether or not we want to share a capability or a system with our partners over a long period of time. Then we finally make a decision, and then we export it. We must compress those timelines if we're to remain competitive. But we understand there's always a cost-benefit analysis. The benefit of sharing these technologies and systems with our allies or partners against the potential cost of losing our technological edge. And so we cannot sacrifice due diligence, but we must adjudicate these issues faster. The third thing that we have to do is we have to demonstrate to our partners the added value of our total package, transparent, and values-based approach. Now, what I mean by that is, with most of our strategic competitors, when they sell you something, they just walk away. They're done. Okay? Whereas our approach has always been not only to provide our partners with the systems themselves, but training, education, institutional capacity building, helping them to build the institutions that will help them to maximize the performance envelope of the equipment, and this commitment to a long-term relationship. We have a responsibility to demonstrate to our allies and partners that there's value in this. And yes, it may cost a little bit more, but my mother used to say, you know, if you want value, pay a little bit more for value. You won't have to buy the same thing over and over again. And I like to feel that our approach is that way. Our sustained total package approach, I like to say, is the gift that keeps on giving. And I have a great example of that in our old area, the Kenyans. I was in Kenya about 6 months ago, and I had an opportunity to go out to some of their airfields. And so they are flying 40-year-old F-5 fighters. That's their principal intercept fighter in the Kenyan Air Force. And I'm sitting out there, and I'm watching these F-5 fighters. They're over 40 years old. They're taking off and landing in Kenya, and they're taking off and landing next to three-year-old Chinese helicopters that are no longer flying. Okay, new Chinese helicopters that are no longer flying. So what's the difference? Why are our 40-year-old aircraft still flying and the three-year-old Chinese aircraft are not? The difference was we made a commitment to the Kenyan Air Force to help them to develop a culture of maintenance excellence that allows them to continue to repair and maintain their 40-year-old U.S. aircraft while the Chinese, the new Chinese helicopters, are no longer flying. And that's the distinction that separates us from our strategic competitors, and we need to make sure they understand that. So if we do those three things, and if we continue what I call a values-based approach, transparency, integrity of our approach, we will be able to win the strategic competition, and our strategic competitors won't even come close.
Thanks, General Hooper. A part of that long-term relationship that the U.S. seeks to establish with many nations around the world is international military education and training. You've had a lot of experience in that in a number of the positions that you've held, particularly in your more senior positions in the Army. Talk a bit about how you see the value of IMET to both the sending nation, but also to U.S. Officers and non-commissioned officers who have that experience of engaging with international students.
Let me say upfront and plainly, as clearly as I can, dollar for dollar, our international military student programs are the best investment we can make in security cooperation. Countless times I've seen the return on investment of our international military student programs. Now, you may wonder, why am I using that instead of IMET? And the reason is, I wanted to clarify for our listeners that IMET as a program, International Military Education and Training, is only one of a number of programs that fund our international military student programs. So, for example, I would tell you that the program that funds most of our student study in the United States is not IMET at all, but foreign military sales. That is, countries that pay for their own students to come to the United States. There's also foreign military financing, where we provide countries with funds and they use those funds to fund their students. Then there's IMET as a discrete program. And then, of course, there are fellowship programs like the counterterrorism fellowship programs. But it is dollar for dollar the best investment we can make. Why? Because at the end of the day, when we discuss interoperability, when we discuss alliances and partnerships, essentially what we're talking about is human relationships. And I would argue that the weapons that we provide themselves serve as the basis for a human relationship. Because the world looks the same to you if you're looking out of the same cockpit canopy, if you're an F-16 pilot and they're an F-16 pilot, or if you're looking through an M1 Abrams sight reticle. And I've seen countless examples throughout my career. I'll tell two quick stories that kind of illustrate the importance of this. And both of them have to do with Egypt. One has to do with China. Very quickly, when I was a lieutenant colonel, assistant army attaché, my next door neighbor was the Egyptian assistant air attaché. And he had just converted from MiGs to the F-16. He was one of the first Egyptian F-16 pilots, which speaks to his quality and his abilities. And based upon the fact that he had studied in the United States and he was our neighbor, we got to know each other very well. My girls were about the same age and they played together with his boys and we ate over each other's houses. Long story short, 20 years later, I found myself as the defense attaché to Egypt at a time where the relationship was at a low point. We had suspended all military aid to Egypt. I was going to my first meeting with the chief of Egyptian Air Force procurement. And you guessed it. When I walked in that room, neither one of us knew the other was going to be in that room. But when I walked in that room, my old friend was there as the major general and the chief of Egyptian Air Force procurement. And based upon that relationship, we were able to work through some very difficult issues during a very difficult time in the bilateral relationship. Let me fast forward again to my time in Egypt, where during that difficult time, I will tell you, my phone calls were always answered. The reason that they were answered was the president of Egypt is a graduate of Fort Benning and the Army War College. The minister of defense at that time was a graduate of Fort Benning and the Army War College. The chief of defense was a graduate of the Armor Center at Fort Knox, Kentucky. The chief of the Air Force was an F-16 pilot who had studied in the United States. The commander of the Egyptian Navy was a Newport, Rhode Island Naval War College graduate. So all of the people that I dealt with in the Egyptian hierarchy had all graduated from U.S. schools. And let me tell you, they were proud of that. I was in China for 7 years. Very rarely did they answer my phone calls, but there was never a time where an Egyptian senior official did not answer my phone calls. And I attribute that to the international education that they got in the United States. On the other side of it, our students have an opportunity to forge relationships with the cream of the international military officers, because only the best come to the United States. And those relationships that are forged here, the way we welcome international students, pays enormous dividends, and I've seen those dividends firsthand, sir.
Oh, thanks. That's a powerful testimony of the importance of those programs. And I do recall lots and lots of times as you and I were in Africa encountering leaders of African militaries who had participated in U.S. training and education programs from very senior ranks to very junior leaders. And you're exactly right. They were incredibly proud of that. And those are relationships that will work to the benefit of our nation for years and years to come. Let me take you back to China for a moment. And you commented about China's competitiveness in the international arms market. They're probably our biggest competitor in that global market. You are certainly one of the Defense Department's leading China experts. You've studied Chinese, you've served in China, and now you're leading America's competition with China in the security assistance arena. How has China changed since you first started focusing on that nation in the 1970s while you were still at West Point? What concerns you now? And how do you see that the U.S. can most effectively compete with China below the threshold of conflict?
Very good question, sir. And I'll start out with how China has changed, because I think the changes that I've seen, I often tell people I've been blessed to have had a front row center court seat to watch the rise of China from the 1970s, 1980s, all the way until now. And let me use a couple of anecdotes to illustrate how far they have come. When I was a student at the military academy, of course, we didn't even have relations with China. People knew very little about China. And many of our students, for example, our Army Foreign Area officers, they would study in Taiwan, they would study in Hong Kong, and the best that they could do was to go up to the fence line at Hong Kong when it was still a British possession and look over the fence line. And there was nothing over that fence line I can remember from the 1980s when I first went, but rice paddies. And so the first time I went to China as a student in late 1980s, there was one copper hardline phone for every 15,000 people. And even when I was a student, if you wanted to make an international phone call in those days, you had to line up at the corner store, pay your money, and make a phone call at the corner store. By the time I came back as a lieutenant colonel, as the assistant attaché in 1995, there were spools of fiber optic cable literally on every street corner in China. And finally, when I came back as a brigadier general, as a defense attaché in 2007, I can remember being in the middle of the Gobi Desert, and I mean the middle of the Gobi Desert, on a camel, looking at my cell phone, and I had five bars in the middle of the desert in the Gobi Desert. So all of that happened during the course of my military career, and the course of my short military career, I was able to see them go from no telephones to skipping a generation of technology to now having a 21st century communications infrastructure. And who would have predicted when I was a cadet in 1975, when they were emerging from famine and the Cultural Revolution, that we would be discussing whether or not they were dominating the 5G cellular technology industry. So that kind of illustrates the changes that have taken place. I want to change the characterization of the strategic competition. We are not competing with China. China is competing with us. And that is a distinction with a difference. We remain the preeminent power, economic and military, in the world, and China is competing with us. And it's important to remember that. They have to play our game. We are not playing their game. This competition will continue for years to come. However, I will say over the last few years, I've seen the U.S. government come together like never before to address this competition. And I've never seen a better level of coordination within the U.S. government to address the problems from this rising China. They are being more aggressive. They are very confident. They see their country rising. They see their economy getting stronger. And that has generated a bit of confidence in the Chinese people and the Chinese military that they can challenge us. In my realm in foreign military sales, the challenge comes in the form of, and there's no polite way to put this, cheap, they're marketing cheap knockoffs of U.S. equipment. I went to one trade show not too long ago before the COVID pandemic, and of course I speak Chinese, and when I'm in my Class B uniform, it was difficult for the Chinese exhibitors to know what country I came from. I speak Chinese, and so I'd ask them, and literally, there was a Chinese anti-tank missile on there, and literally in Chinese, there was a sign that said, exactly like the TOW-2B. I mean, it was that blatant. So their strategy is to sell cheaper versions of our weapon systems, and our counter to that challenge is merely to point out, as I would do sometimes to our African partners, you can buy a cheap knockoff, but it'll break, and you'll have to buy another one and another one, or you can invest in a U.S. system and the full spectrum of support that comes with that. I used to tell them that you can put a camera on a plane. I used to do it when I was a kid on Estes rockets, but the ability to work with you and help you interpret the photographs, for example, that a plane or a UAV takes, that's the strength of the capability, and only the United States can do with that. So the bottom line, sir, is I think the competition will continue. I don't think, my personal opinion is war is not inevitable. The Chinese very clearly understand what would be lost to them in terms of economic development in the event of an armed conflict, but they will certainly continue to press and push to fulfill what they believe is their destiny to be a preeminent power in Asia and in the world.
Well, thanks for your insights. You have unique information based upon your long experience, and that's very valuable to all of us. I would be remiss if I let this conversation about China go without asking you about an anecdote of which I've heard over many years. And there is a report several years ago of a very large African-American young Army officer rollerblading through Tiananmen Square. Might you have any information about that?
I might indeed, and what a testament to the changes in China. So yes, sir, I used to rollerblade through Tiananmen Square, and my favorite anecdote on that, and now I could never do that, of course, because Chang'an Boulevard, which is the large street that runs through Tiananmen Square, on any given day is full of Mercedes-Benz cars. It's a nonstop traffic jam. But my favorite story about that very quickly was I was rollerblading through Tiananmen Square, which, as you might imagine, always attracted a little bit of attention. And so I was rollerblading on the street past the square, and I was stopped by one policeman who told me that since I was a pedestrian, I had to use the pedestrian underpass that went under Tiananmen Square to the other side of Tiananmen Square. And so I went to the underground pedestrian walkway where I was stopped by another policeman who told me that wheeled vehicles were not allowed in the underpass. And so I had told him that the other policeman had told me that I wasn't a wheeled vehicle, I was a pedestrian. He called his counterpart over, and they engaged in a spirited argument over whether I was a vehicle or a pedestrian, at which time I just rollerbladed away. So if that's not an illustration of China as well, I don't know what is.
Yeah, pretty amazing. And who would think that one would experience things such as that in a very diverse Army career? Let me turn to one final question on a much more serious topic than rollerblading through Tiananmen Square. You're one of the most senior African-American officers in the Army, indeed one of the most senior African-American officers in all the armed forces. And there's no question that you have seen significant change in equal opportunity and social justice and inclusiveness in the Army since you first showed up at West Point in 1975. But there's also no question that much remains yet to be done. Talk a bit about the steps that we all should be thinking about in both the near term and more broadly, more institutionally, to help the Army achieve its goals in this area.
Thank you. Thank you for that question, sir. And it's something that I feel very deeply and passionately about. And let me start with the positives. Our Army, my Army, has always led the nation. And in fact, if I say humbly, the Department of Defense in providing equal opportunity for all on the basis of their skills and their dedication and nothing more. And so I wanted to begin with the positive note of that. And I can remember my dad telling me all those years ago when I was looking at universities and colleges and careers, and I settled on the military and West Point, him telling me, well, that's good, son, because in the Army, in the military, you'll get a fair shake. And that was just my dad's way of acknowledging as a former Marine that he felt that in the military and in the Army, I'd have an opportunity to demonstrate and be rewarded on my talent. And so we've done that, and the Army has always led the way. But this is a journey and not a destination, and there's more that we can do. Two things I'd like to point out to you. One is organizational, and one is more personal. The organizational one is, perhaps I'm wrong and I could be mistaken, but I was thinking the other day about all of my training and education, Army training and education as a general officer, the ASEP program. And I was trying to recall at my one-star course, at my two-star course, and at my final three-star capstone course, whether or not I had had any classes on diversity or the importance of diversity and my responsibility as an Army leader to support that. And I couldn't recall, and perhaps I'm wrong, perhaps it was there, but I couldn't recall in any of those courses any discussion. So the first recommendation I'd make is that this must come from the Army leadership, and I know the Secretary and the Chief and the Vice have all expressed in writing their commitment to diversity. As I recall, I'd like to look at those ASEP courses. The second thing I'd like to talk about, and this is very important, is the personal aspect. Let's be honest. The nurturing of leaders to make sure that they are both prepared, number one, and that they are given an opportunity to demonstrate their ability, number two, it still tends to be subjective and very personal. And as I look at my career, I was blessed to have leaders, and sir, I must include you very much in this group, that were willing to not only recognize my abilities and my dedication, but also took the time to mentor me, to teach, and to provide those opportunities for me to excel. That's a very personal decision. It's very subjective in nature, but we need, at the very least, to increase awareness of the responsibility of our leaders to cast a wider net when nurturing and mentoring people. And I must tell this anecdote to illustrate what I'm saying. There have been a couple of times in my career as a senior officer, a colonel promoter, promotable or above, where I've been in rooms where I've seen senior Army leaders who appear to have very familiar relationships with many officers in the room, but regrettably not some of the minority or female officers in the room. And I remember recalling, how did that come to be? How did it come to be that this senior Army leader seemed to be familiar with many of the people in the room, but not the minority officers and not sometimes the female officers? And that's when I came to this conclusion that it is a personal choice and that we must sensitize our leaders to reach out, to establish relationships with people with whom perhaps they don't share a background or a hometown or many commonalities, but to reach out and take the time to get to know them, nurture them, and mentor them. And I'll stop there.
Thanks for those insights. This is a journey that we are all on, and perhaps the present time, more so than any other, at least in my experience, affords us the opportunity to have the kind of conversations, to be introspective, both individually and institutionally across the Army and all the armed forces, to ask ourselves, not what should they be doing, but what should I be doing to help achieve the goals that the Army and the entirety of the Department of Defense, and indeed the nation, seeks to achieve. So thanks for your insights in that. I do recall, as you were speaking, it was more than 10 years ago when you and I first had a conversation about DSCA might be a good job for you in the future. And here we are. You earned that. And I think that perhaps instructive in the examples that you offered. Next week, you will hand over the reins of the Defense Security Cooperation Agency, and you will participate in your retirement ceremony from the Army after more than 40 years of service. What's next for you? What are you thinking about?
First of all, thank you for the kind words, and I've been blessed beyond, and I must say that, beyond measure, because people have recognized my hard work and my determination, so I'm thankful for that. So what's next for me? At the core of my being, I've always seen my role in this world as trying to make it better, trying to make my community better, trying to make my nation better. I am a soldier for life, and I will always make myself available to my Army to help make it better. I'm a United States Army Foreign Area Officer. I'm very proud of that, and it's been the humbling honor of my life to be the senior foreign area officer and have an opportunity to demonstrate what FAOs can do, to validate the Army's investment in the FAO program. And even though I'll take my uniform off, I'll still be a mentor to the FAOs and stay involved in that as well. I look forward to the opportunity perhaps to teach and share some of the things that I've learned over time, perhaps contributing to Army mentorship programs or in academia. And I'm going to fish a lot, to be honest with you, sir, and enjoy my family. But at the end of the day, serving my community, my Army, and my country, it's what gets me excited. It's what gets me up in the morning. And even if it's just sweeping the steps in front of the church, volunteering at voter registration, those are the things I'm looking forward to doing when I take my uniform off.
Well, Lieutenant General Charles Hooper, Wayne, as your mother calls you, thank you, not just for this podcast today, but thank you for a lifelong of service to the Army and to the nation. We wish you and your family well for the next chapters in your lives that will be exciting, perhaps different than what you've been doing for the past 40 years, but perhaps there will be some time for fishing and maybe a Philadelphia Eagles football game or two in your future. But thank you so much for your insights, and thank you for joining us today. Ladies and gentlemen, we are pleased that you have joined us for this podcast with Lieutenant General Charles Hooper, Director of the Defense Security Cooperation Agency, on the Army Matters podcast. We look forward to joining you in the future. Thank you.
To all our listeners, thanks for joining us. Be sure to subscribe to the Army Matters podcast on iTunes and everywhere podcasts are found. Join us next Monday with a brand new episode of Army Matters with Army Real Talk. The Army Matters podcast series is brought to you by the Association of the United States Army, the U.S. Army's professional association, member-supported, Army-connected. Visit us at AUSA.org for more information or to become a member. Your membership helps AUSA continue to carry out its mission to educate, inform, and connect with the total Army, our industry partners, and our supporters of a strong national defense. For questions or to provide topic recommendations, email us at podcast@AUSA.org. Have a great Army Day. Hooah.